Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Monday, I guess as happy as you can be in the middle of an economic meltdown, a political lockdown of some sorts, and of course the spreading pandemic. And we are joined by our good friend Benjamin Wittes of Lawfare. Good morning. How are you doing, first of all?
I'm hanging in there. I am much better off than a lot of people, just in terms of being healthy and being less disrupted. Lawfare is relatively virtual anyway, and I'm bored out of my skull sitting at home. So, you know, I think probably like a lot of people right now.
Well, you know, a week ago today, I missed the podcast. I very rarely miss this podcast, but I was off, and I should have explained what I was doing. But my wife and I drove to Iowa to pick up a new puppy. We have a new German Shepherd puppy. So the last week has been a lot of puppy action, which I have to tell you is the distraction that I think America needs right now. And I do promise that I will post more puppy videos on Twitter and YouTube and things like that, because we need something. Because, you know, it did occur to me that this is, and I wrote this in my newsletter yesterday, this is a 2 a.m. crisis for a lot of us, where we wake up and we can't get back to sleep because we just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, I know there's all this rah-rah talk about how we're all in this together, but the fact is that we're very, very isolated right now. We don't know what to believe. We don't know who to believe. We don't know how deep this economic downturn is going to be, or how many people are going to die from all of this. So, you know, I mean, I struggle to come up with more positive things to say, but this is a moment of real anxiety, and I think it's reflected in the markets, it's reflected in our politics, it's reflected in our culture. So Benjamin, my solution is puppies. More puppy videos.
You know, I think the more puppies approach is important, because, like, here's the thing. You know, there's an old saying, everybody dies alone. Everybody also wakes up at 2 a.m. alone. I mean, and by the way, if you don't, it's because you're waking somebody else up, and that's a bit of a problem, right? And so the nice thing about puppies is when you wake up at 2 a.m., they are there and they want to jump on you. And,
that's right.
You know, that is very hard to argue with.
And it's very cute as long as you can get them outside before they pee on you.
Right.
Although we're also in the chewy, bitey phase where they have these little needly teeth, and it is tough. Okay, so let's talk about where we're at right now, because it does appear, I mean, today's storyline is obviously going to be the markets and the politics. We'll get to the $2 trillion stimulus package and the politics there in a moment. But I get a sense that we've already exhausted Donald Trump's attention span on the medical aspect of this. This is from the Washington Post. I want to talk about this. President Trump is signaling interest in scaling back social distancing and other steps promoted by health officials to contain the virus, as a growing number of conservatives are now arguing the impact of the U.S. on the U.S. economy has become too severe. So this is what Trump tweeted last night, all in caps. We cannot let the cure be worse than the problem itself. At the end of the 15-day period, we will make a decision as to which way we want to go. And there are reports that in the president's inner circle, they are now regretting that they took the advice of the medical experts and let the medical experts set the policy at the expense of the economy. And so now there is a bit of blowback. So we could look for a pivot very, very shortly. And Jonathan Swain, I think, tweeted this out a little while ago, that we're about to get to this point very, very shortly where, you know, the president, he said, what's next is at the end of this shutdown period, there will likely be a serious clash between the public health experts versus the president and his economic and political aides, who are anxious to restart the economy. So our divide is about to get deeper and perhaps more deadly.
I say this at the risk of giving the Trump administration too much credit, but I think that my gut is that that's the sort of thing that you can say or tweet in the president's case, in all caps, by the way, before the fact. But it is actually quite hard to pull the trigger on the Northern Italy model, and to say, yeah, it's fine. We would rather have, a mass casualty scenario than the economic consequences that we're going to face. And the goal really isn't to save as many lives as possible and to take the economic hit. The goal is to figure out what the economic value of the lives you're going to lose are, and to figure out the economic value of the stimulus, and do whichever one will save you more money. And I think that's the kind of thing that maybe you can flirt with if you're surrounding yourself with the most bloodless kind of economists, and you inject a little bit of magical thinking into it. But it's actually very hard to say to the American people, I've looked at Italy and I've looked at South Korea, and gosh, I choose Italy.
Ooh, well, okay. So here's my, and I'm trying not to be too dark here, because I give the president credit for having the reptilian cunning and his instinct. And what you're starting to see, before I get to that, what you're starting to see in a lot of the conservative media, including guy from Judicial Watch, is this trade off, which is that, okay, maybe we'll have a few hundred thousand people die, but is that really worse than tens of millions of people losing their jobs? And I think that Trump, at some level, given his Trumpism, and by that I mean his personality, is that I think he understands that he'd be hurt more by a tanked economy than even by hundreds of thousands of Americans dying, because a lot of those deaths will take place. This is really cynical, but I am cynical. It will take place in blue states, and he can blame that on the Chinese and others, but he knows that he owns the economy, that the one thing he cannot survive is a massive recession, depression. And therefore, when they're sitting around and it is the economic hawks versus the medical experts, I think there's a very good chance that he will side with the economic hawks.
So I want to argue with the premise here. And I am not predicting Trump's behavior, because I, try never to do that, because it's so difficult to predict. And so, but I am saying, look, I don't think the premise that he can survive 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 American deaths that are attributable to policy choices that he made. It's different if you have an earthquake that kills a lot of people, if you have, some terrible combination of organic circumstances that you actually can't control. But if you make the decision to turn off social distancing or scale it back, and in the face of foreknowledge that public health people believe this will lead to a lot of deaths, and it will fatten rather than flatten the curve, and it in fact does that, that is a very different scenario, and one that is going to be very hard to blame the Chinese for or shirk responsibility for yourself. By contrast, I think you actually could argue that the economic fallout that we're going to experience is a kind of act of God. And, it's not like any other country isn't facing the same economic catastrophe that we are. China got this, at least for now, got the virus under control at immense economic cost, the totals of which we have no idea what they look like. But I think that damage, you could say, is something that you didn't cause and you're trying to ameliorate. But knowingly making policy choices that cause very large numbers of people to die is going to be presented politically as a kind of manslaughter, and probably should be.
Well, I agree with that, and I guess this is the assumption that they will make that on that kind of a rational basis. But I've already started to see the spin. You know, people saying, "Well, we have 40,000 people die of the flu every year. You know, this many people die of traffic deaths, and we do not shut down the economy." So the combination: blame the Chinese, give the president, credit for winning. I mean, just simply declare victory and move on. That political temptation will be there. See, because one of his problems, I think, right now, is that, and I'm going to give McKay Coppins from The Atlantic credit for this. He said some of this is already happening. It seems like very soon social distancing is going to be treated by many primarily as a political act, a way of signaling which side you are on. And I think one of the problems that Trump faces is he's a wartime general, but many of his followers have already been conditioned to think it's no big deal. You know, really believed him when he said that this was kind of a media hoax. He didn't say that exactly, but you know that it was really no big deal. That the Democrats and the media are trying to destroy him. So you look at the divide, the partisan divide out there. You look at the maps and the way people are behaving. And here you have a wartime president, but many of his followers have already been conditioned to not treat it as war. So he knows that if he backs off, if he declares victory, because he will say it, and then he will have his sycophants surround him and tell him that he was the great war leader who solved this problem, et cetera. And then at least they try to salvage the economy. I mean, I could imagine that his tribe will still rally around him. I'm trying to think of one Trumpist who has broken with Trump decisively based on his failures, his lies, the foot dragging. And it, so far, that center is held for him.
The resilience of Trump's poll numbers are of a piece on this with the resilience of his poll numbers in the face of lots of other disasters that he's had. And I don't do political prognostication, so I don't know whether that will persist or will deteriorate as the full scope of the economic and public health disaster comes into focus. I do think that it is hard to imagine a greater presidential failure than the one that we are seeing right now, which is layering a public health catastrophe on top of, or layering an economic catastrophe on top of a public health catastrophe. And so, I mean, the president famously said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose a single, voter. Now what he's saying is he can cause hundreds of thousands of people to die and not lose a single vote. Color me a little bit suspicious of that. You know, you don't need the most prominent Trumpists to confess error here to imagine a 5 to 6 point shaving off of his approval rating, which would be immense. That said, we haven't seen any evidence of it yet, and I don't know that it's going to happen in the short term, though it might happen in the mid or longer term.
Yeah, and you know, he may right now be thinking that he wants to see an end to this national slowdown, you know, much, much earlier than the health experts are advising. But one of the complications is our federal system, where many of these decisions are being made by governors, not by the federal government. So he could do this say, hey, everybody go back to work, but that doesn't mean they will do that in places like New York, California, Illinois, or here in Wisconsin, where they just ordered a shutdown of non-essential businesses. So this can be awfully messy. Okay, so let's talk about where we're at here on this massive stimulus. And as you and I are talking, there is not a deal yet. One presumes there will be a deal. There had been a lot of fears that the stock market would absolutely crater today because of the standoff. That doesn't seem to be happening at the moment. I want to underline at the moment. The Fed has essentially opened up the doors and said, we will buy unlimited amounts of bonds. So the floodgates have absolutely been opened. But we are rushing toward spending $2 trillion. And you know, the complexity of that, the potential for getting it wrong, the way the lobbyists and the special interests are swarming like locusts. The reports that there is a $500 billion slush fund that would be controlled by the Treasury Secretary. What is your sense about the state of play there, and what Democrats and Republicans need to do to come to some sort of a deal?
All right. So I want to caveat this by saying I'm not a macroeconomist. Yeah. And
neither of us.
And so, you know, my opinion on this subject is that of a layman who has certain instincts, but is in no sense expert. Look, first of all, first observation is we are all Keynesians now. And the only question is, what type of Keynesian are you in this environment?
Well, I think we're all socialists now. That's the way it feels.
The second point is that I don't have a problem with that. I think that the broad idea that running huge deficits is what you do in a crisis to stabilize things. And sometimes those crises are like World War II. You have to, you know, defeat the Nazis and Imperial Japan, and you have to spend an astronomical percentage of GDP on that. Sometimes it's like the Great Depression. Sometimes it's like this, right? And so I don't have a problem with, I don't know what the right number of stimulus is, but I don't have a problem with the idea that this is the time in a nation's life where you just borrow. And by the way, interest rates are, you know, not high. And so, you know, the cost of that is relatively cheap. I have a huge problem with the fact that we were doing that already. And we were running the kind of deficits you should run in a crisis when there was no crisis. And so we dug this hole of debt for ourselves in the Trump administration in a fashion that is frankly unforgivable. We were on a path, we were not on a reasonable path toward a balanced budget, but we were on a path toward lower deficits when the president came in after the 2009 crisis, when we had to do a lot of spending. And I think that was the appropriate time to have serious conversations. And there were, you know, starting with Simpson-Bowles and some other, there were conversations about how to get spending and the deficit under control, and how to get, how to think about entitlements in that context. And we did not complete that process. And the result, and then Trump comes in and blows a hole in the deficit with a completely irresponsible tax cut. And the result is that we are starting this process from a point in which the necessary deficit spending that we're engaged in right now comes on top of deficit spending we were already doing. And I think that is actually not a function of the current crisis. It's a function of irresponsible fiscal stewardship on the part of both parties, by the way, but particularly the Trump administration in the last several years.
Well, and think about the position it will leave us in afterwards, when we have $2 or $3 trillion now added to the debt, because every nickel, of course, will be borrowed. This is not the last crisis necessarily. So the next president comes into office, and all the money spent, all the money is gone. The economy is broken, and the bullets are out. I mean, we're out of ammunition completely. I know this is dawning on a lot of Democrats that, you know, this is they're going to inherit kind of a mess. I guess there's a couple of things about this, including how you go about spreading this money around. And I have to say that I'm somewhat sympathetic to some of the Democrats who are saying, look, we need to strengthen the safety net, make sure the money goes to the people who need it, have job guarantees as opposed to, you know, top-down corporate bailouts. I mean, clearly you want to make credit available to small businesses to keep people employed. But the whole idea of sending out checks, which I understand is very, very attractive, is really complicated particularly when you get to the question of whether you want to means test this. And, you know, the problem of means testing, saying, you know, nobody who makes above $70,000, well, you know, phase it out at $70,000 a year. Well, how do you know? Because there are a lot of people who might have made money last year who are not making any money this year. And yet, if you don't means test it, then you are wasting a huge amount of money. One more point here, and this is, I'm basing this on sort of post 9/11, my experience. The scandals that come out from this, the insider dealing, the grift and the graft, I think the reaction to that is going to be really explosive. I think there's a sense that, okay, it's same old in the era of swampy Trumpism and everything. But don't sleep on the way that I think people are getting frustrated and they're getting angry, which is why I think some of these scandals will play differently than they might have played before. And I'm including Senators Burr and Senator Loeffler. I just think there's going to be a level of blowback that is going to be more intense than sort of the shoulder shrugging that we've had over the last couple of years. Any thoughts on the insider dealing from some of these senators? Because I think, by the way, that's just the tip of the iceberg so far.
So I mean, I was, like a lot of people, shocked by that story, and I, you know, flatter myself that I don't shock easily anymore, but I was quite shocked. I did note that both senators had some explanation for it, which I will, you know, defer to the Senate Ethics Committee and ultimately to whatever investigations take place. That said, it's a genuinely shocking series of events, and the idea that senators would be out there warning people to stay calm and that the whole thing is under control while unloading stocks, either based on or informed by or with an awareness of privileged information or classified information about how bad the situation is like everybody's worst nightmare of how the Senate works and what the how the club behaves. I do agree with you that the question of how to shovel a huge amount of money into the system in a fashion that minimizes graft and insider dealing, even of a legal variety, but also is maximally efficient in terms of providing stimulus and also just providing help to people who need it, is a good one. And I have, like, again, three kind of guidepost principles in my mind, but about what the priorities should be. And it seems to me priority number one is shoring up the social safety net, making sure that people, have who are very, very suddenly out of work with no severance and no, are maximally protected. So that's the sort of individual level. Second level is, to do something, bridge loans, whatever, so that small businesses who are the lion's share of the employers survive long enough to come back online. And then the third is, I do think we should limit major corporate bailouts to critical industries. Like, in exactly the same way as post 9/11, we can't let the airline industry fail. Not because it's too big to fail, but because it's too damn important to fail. And so, in the post 9/11 era, this is, I think, one of the great unsung triumphs of the Bush administration and the Congress at the time, is they acted extremely swiftly and decisively to protect the airlines. And that worked. It worked really, really well. And I think we can, we should think about what are the industries that are so essential that not out of any corporate largesse or something. We just want to make sure those industries are alive. And on the other hand, I don't really have a problem letting the cruise ship industry fail. I, it's an environmental catastrophe under the best of circumstances, and it does not provide a critical service. And so I think we need to be pretty hard-nosed about what are the industries that is a kind of corporate bailout that we just want to treat as a moral hazard issue, and what are the industries that are so essential that we actually do want to intervene to protect them.
You know, I've never been on a cruise, and I probably never will be now. I've always thought that would be
fun. Yeah, I think
now that you look at the picture, you go, floating Petri dish, not getting on.
Yeah, I mean, what is attractive about the cruise industry today? And look, I mean, anytime a major industry fails, you're talking about large numbers of jobs that get lost, and those are real people. And so I'm not, you know, I'm not dancing on the cruise industry's grave at all, assuming that there is a grave, or I'm not, you know, praying for its demise. I am saying, when you're thinking about how to allocate, you know, government bailout resources to major corporations in this environment, I'm much less concerned about entertainment industry components than I am about components that provide critical services to the national economy.
What I'm concerned about, and I saw a lot of this over the weekend, and keeping in mind that we're talking about spending $2 trillion over a weekend, that the mood is, you know, do something, go big, stop squabbling, just get this done. And it's like, wait. This is the formula for really bad legislation, even worse policy, because the quote-unquote squabbling is actually what we do in our constitutional republic. You know, it is a moment where you take a deep breath. You know, the system is not set up to have the federal government be able to come in and essentially take over the economy in 2 or 3 days, right? So some of the frustration of just get it done, I understand the emotion behind it. I mean, I understand, you know, the danger to the economy. But also, I think, you know, there are fundamental values being debated here. There are fundamental issues, you know, that we need to talk about. And I have to tell you, I just have this instinctive fear, you know, loathing would be a stronger word, of these quickie deals done in secret, voted on, and nobody has any idea what they are. And you know, you know that the system is, to quote Bernie Sanders, is completely rigged, and that bothers me. Okay, I have to ask
So just on that point, I really agree with that point. I mean, there is no way, not 1% of an iota of a chance, that Congress is not going to act. And, you know, the political incentives, the economic necessity of Congress passing a major package are so overwhelming that it is simply going to happen. Conversely, there really is a danger of Congress doing something that is ill-considered and that does not think through what is happening with $2 trillion and how it's going to be managed. And the issues that Senate Democrats raised over the weekend are legitimate issues. And that's not to say that they ultimately should prevail, although I think they probably should on some of those issues. But it is certainly not a terrible thing for them to say, hey, if you want our votes, there are some things we need to do.
Right. On the other hand, you know, when you start to Christmas tree it, and I mean, I saw that Joe Biden came out in favor of what, you know, forgiving, you know, stop collecting student loans. Apparently, we're no longer charging interest rate on the student loans. But it's like, if we could just stay focused on dealing with this problem as opposed to exploiting the crisis in order to get some policy thing that you've wanted for a long time. I think one of the things that jumped out at me was the health club industry has been pushing to have health club memberships be pre-tax, so that you could join your local health club and it would be deductible or would not be taxed. You know, maybe that's a good idea. Maybe that's not a bad, but you know, maybe that's not a terrible idea. I don't know.
But it certainly doesn't need to be in this.
Exactly. It's just like,
on the other hand, the Democrats' concern that putting a $500 billion fund in the hands of the Treasury Secretary to use for corporations could end up being a vehicle for favored actors getting bailouts is a completely legitimate concern.
Absolutely. No, and that's absolutely obscene. By the way, just one little footnote here is Jake Sherman put this out, I think yesterday, that with all of the senators who are now self-quarantining, which means they can't come to the floor and vote in theory, I guess, the Senate right now is 48 Republicans, 47 Democrats, because you have Lee, Romney, Scott of Florida, Paul, and Gardner all quarantining. So
I wonder if there'll be some point at which the Democrats just seek a new organizing resolution and oust Mitch McConnell.
You know, it's funny you should say this, because I was thinking among, you know, sometimes I think we underestimate, you know, the, you know, contingent, you know, events. Like, what would happen if, in fact, control of the Senate is eventually decided by the coronavirus as opposed to the election? I know that sounds morbid and ghoulish, but it is a strange moment. Okay, one other thing. You know, you and I have spent most of the last year and a half talking about the rule of law and those issues. One of the other dangers of a sense of panic and emergency is that we don't care about whether we are economically conservative, but also there seems to be less focus on civil rights and civil liberties. What is your level of concern about the way we are being habituated to government orders telling us who can go to work, who can run businesses, who can leave their homes? I understand the medical necessity, and I'm not saying I oppose them. I just I'm a little bit nervous, though, about what precedents we're establishing. And I'm like, I'll get to elections in a moment. Any concerns on your part?
Well, if you're not concerned, you're not thinking about it. If you're overly concerned, you're running roughshod over public health concerns at this point.
People's
so here,
lives,
I mean, here.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, look, here is, first of all, the history of government taking coercive measures and having authority to take coercive measures for purposes of disease control is actually very old. The precedents here are not ones we are establishing now. They're relatively long established, and they're reasonably robust, if quite contingent on the existence of a genuine communicable disease problem. And this goes back to, you know, measures to control leprosy, typhoid, you know, these various communicable diseases that have, you know, been generating small scale or medium scale issues like this for as long as we've had a republic. So the idea that there are coercive mechanisms available is not new. The idea that they amount to shut down the state is new. And you'd mentioned earlier federalism, the idea that these are federal authorities rather than state authorities, that is where I would start to get alarmed. I think, you know, it is one thing for Andrew Cuomo or Gavin Newsom or J.D. Pritzker to order something under the police power of, you know, their respective states. It is quite another thing for the federal government to order things that smack of the local police power. And I think to Trump's credit, or maybe it's not to his credit, he actually hasn't attempted anything like that. He's been, if anything, really, despite all of our fears about his prior invocations of national emergencies, he's been quite restrained in his use of federal power this time around. In fact, I would argue much too restrained there are emergency powers he should be exercising that he's not.
Well, this is interesting to me because he's resisting the pressure to use these wartime laws to mobilize production, the Defense Production Act, which would essentially conscript U.S. businesses to produce required medical gear. And I have to say, I'm sympathetic to his decision. I understand why people, you know, think it's an emergency and you have to do it. I do think that business is probably going to step up. And there is something somewhat ironic, you know, about warning about Donald Trump's authoritarianism and then complaining that he has not used his power to basically force U.S. business to do what the federal government wants. I mean, that's
okay.
Right? I mean,
so yes and no. First of all, I think before you get to the Defense Production Act, I do not understand why certain military components have not been activated, not in order to patrol the streets or in order to, much less for issues that would run up against the Posse Comitatus Act, that is involving the military and law enforcement, but because the military has genuine public health capacities that don't exist in the civilian sector, including the ability to set up quickly large field hospitals. It has an incredible set of emergency medicine capacities. And so I don't really understand, you know, long before you get to coercive measures at the federal level, there are actually non-coercive measures at the federal level that are simply could be done in support of existing state efforts that I don't really understand why they have not been mobilized.
How are you feeling about the elections right now and the prospect?
Not good.
Okay, tell me why you say that.
Well, so first of all, many states have inadequate vote by mail capabilities. And that's not to say that I think we should all go like Washington state and be all vote by mail. But I do think the idea that the presumptive way of voting in a time of a pandemic is going to be for large numbers of people to stand in lines and congregate together in rooms where they can spread virus is going to inhibit a lot of people from voting, and probably rationally so, by the way, not because they're, you know, engaged in a panic or have been fooled by a hoax, but because they're being told in every other aspect of their lives, stay away from groups, don't congregate, and engage in social distancing. And now we're going to go through this civic ritual where we all stand in line together and cough on each other. And that does not seem like a good idea. And so there are states that are exceedingly well positioned to deal with that. And there are a lot of states that aren't. And those states do not seem especially urgent about between now and November, making it so that it's not so that as many people can vote as possible, because anybody can vote, but it's making it so that as many people can vote consistent with the public health guidance that they're getting to not engage in behavior that's going to kill large numbers of people. And I just think a lot of states are not showing the urgency about that one would hope for in this environment. And if you want to get such a structure in place by November, you really have to be working on it right now.
I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but given the number of states that have canceled their primary elections, is it possible for the federal government to postpone the November election? Could Trump do that?
Not legally. The date of the election is set in statute. There is no provision for removing it or postponing it. And the election in any event is not administered by the federal government. It's administered by the state governments. So you could imagine So it's actually hard to imagine moving or canceling the election. What's not hard to imagine is the combination of failure of state action and federal messaging really inhibiting electoral participation.
You know, I'm looking at a press release that just came out this morning on the question of absentee voting, because I know there's a lot of talk about whether or not there should be more guarantees in this stimulus package for the election, and whether or not there should be more of a push to have more mail-in voting. Republicans are not going to roll over on this. I'm looking at a press release. Wisconsin's Republican Party is pushing back on the calls to expand absentee voting. The executive director says it makes no sense to change the rules because that effectively tosses election safeguards out the window because of the coronavirus. The best course of action during elections in time of crisis is to ensure equal access to the polls, not to suspend common sense regulations. So we can see where that's going. I mean, the Republicans are not going to go along with that.
I actually don't understand that. I mean, you're clearly correct that this is shaping up to be a partisan issue. But, you know, if the concern on the, you know, the core Republican voting blocks tend to be older. They tend to be they are more likely to do things like smoke. I don't understand why there's this latent assumption that that this is going to depress turnout among Democrats, and that a more liberal, and by liberal here I mean permissive, policy regarding absentee and write-in votes would aid turnout among Democrats. I don't really understand why Republicans are trying to kill their voters here.
Yeah,
like, that just doesn't seem like a, like in Florida, do you really think it's the young people who are going to be disproportionately affected by this?
Well, that's the
like,
one.
I just don't get it.
Yeah, that is, of course, one of the storylines of 2020 is that the youth vote has not come out, but they've gone to the beach, apparently. And they're willing to go to the beach, and they're willing to go to spring break.
But if those younger people, and by younger people, I don't mean youth, I mean under 50, people who are below the age of the of heightened coronavirus risk, right? And so if you make it easier for people to do remote voting of one sort or another, mail-in ballots and absentee ballots, why do you assume that that's going to assist Democratic constituencies more than it's going to assist the older coronavirus vulnerable people who are the core of the Republican voting base?
Yeah, when they realize that, that will be the moment they make the pivot. It will be just the exactly, hey, never mind about all of these objections. So I don't know about you, but
it should be the slogan: save a Trump voter's life.
Oh my lord! So
go to absentee balloting.
I don't know about you. One of the most fascinating stories for me is watching this Anthony Fauci thing play out, including the interview. You see the interview that he gave to Science Magazine, where he's very, very candid about what it's like having to stand behind Donald Trump while Donald Trump is lying about various things or exaggerating. And at one point he says, what am I supposed to do, throw myself in front of the microphone? I just wonder how long he survives before the Trump machine turns on him. But, you know, we probably can't get ahead of ourselves. So tell me, Ben, what are you watching right now? I mean, you're home, you're hunkered down, you have nothing to distract you. What storylines are you watching?
Other than the ones we've been talking about.
I
thought you meant what Netflix shows am I watching?
Okay, I'm up for that too.
No, I mean, the major storylines that I've been following, first of all, I've been really trying to work on the question of what role lawfare has to play in this discussion. You know, that's an easy question about Ukraine phone calls, and it's an easy question about the Russia stuff, and it's an easy question when the questions are about FISA, and it is not an easy question when we are talking about, you know, a public health emergency and the resulting economic fallout. So one of the issues that I've just been spending a lot of time on is, you know, how to deploy Lawfare's intellectual resources in a fashion that is most useful for the public and useful for the debate, and actually sheds light on things that people are not necessarily going to focus on. So we've done some interesting little projects, like trying to map all of the state level coercive authorities that we were talking, you and I were talking about earlier. We've done now 37 states, and we're continuing to map that out. We've been trying to host some discussions about these emergency powers issues. We actually, for those listeners who want to join us tonight at 8:30, we're having a Zoom conversation with some experts on federal emergency powers. And so we've been, you know, trying to do a certain amount of that. And other than that kind of broader project of sort of helping to sort of shepherd Lawfare and sort of think about what role we're playing, I've just been watching New York and watching Italy with this, you know, increasingly helpless feeling. And I don't have anything deep or important to say about any of it. I've just, you know, it's been, you know, very upsetting, and I also can't take my eyes off it.
Yeah, I feel the same way, except for the Netflix binging. I feel like I'm falling behind because I'm watching all the other people, you know, making lists of the movies that they should watch. So I am actually going out of my way to schedule, besides the puppy time, just, you know, off the grid time, which I think is necessary, because this is another reason why this is a 2 a.m. crisis, is because we have very little control over it. This is one thing where we're just there for the ride, and we don't know where it's going. Benjamin Wittes, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast, one of our earliest adopters and one of our best friends. Thank you so much.
Anytime. You know, it's not like I have all that much to do these days. So anytime I'm welcome, I will show up.
All right. Thank you so much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.